On a hill in Wisconsin sits a house that shows what happens when a great architect encounters a landscape worthy of their talent. It got its start in 1911 when Frank Lloyd Wright found the perfect place to build his new home and studio. His grandparents had settled down in nearby Spring Green after emigrating from Wales, and he had been born just up the road in Richland Center, so he knew the landscape intimately. This was important to the architect, who had established his reputation with early masterpieces such as the Robey House, Unity Temple, and his own previous house, all in the Chicago area. He was the most prominent member of the Prairie School, a movement that not only held that architecture should be inspired by nature, but should be integrated into it. At Spring Green, he found an environment in which he could really explore the possibilities of the Prairie School philosophy. Along the Wisconsin River and the many streams that feed into it, rich soils support farms, not an unusual sight across the Midwest, the breadbasket of the U.S. More unusual are the steep, forested hills that rise up out of those valleys, which might look more at home in New England or Appalachia. It was on one of these hills that Wright built the home he would call Taliesin, a Welsh term meaning shining brow. The name refers to its location, not on the peak of the hill, but dug into a ridge just below, where it overlooks the valley without dominating it. In true Prairie School fashion, the design of the house as well as its location reflect the natural world of southwest Wisconsin. Wright's use of windows and landscaping blurs the line between inside and outside. His preferred building material was locally quarried limestone, and he would add a soaring balcony known as the Birdwalk, so named because it allowed visitors to walk among birds as they both soared over the valley. But the most spectacular link between Taliesin and its landscape is the result of one of Wright's favorite architectural tricks. As you enter the building, you pass through a narrow, almost claustrophobic hall, only to emerge into the main room, whose panoramic views of farmland and the wooded hills beyond seem that much more impressive given the passageway you were just in. It remains as stunning today as it would have been in the early 20th century, and it's a scene that Wright simply couldn't have set in his earlier buildings on the flat lakeshore of Chicago. Spring Green is less than 150 miles from his home and studio in Oak Park, so why the all-important difference in landscape? Why doesn't Taliesin sit on the same plains that characterize most of the Midwest? The answer comes down to the two forces that have most visibly shaped our planet's surface. One, slow, relentless, and unimaginably powerful, irrevocably changed the Great Lakes region, but, for reasons still unclear, didn't touch a patch of land along the borders of Minnesota, Iowa, Wisconsin, and Illinois. Here, the second force was left to carve out the most rugged landscape between the Black Hills and the Alleghenies. Join me as we explore this unique ecosystem to see how its roots in the Ice Age and the flow of America's Great River gave it its environmental and cultural character and its name, the Driftless Area. Welcome aboard the Voyages Podcast. I'm John Orcutt, and unless you follow me on social media, at VoyagePod on Instagram and Facebook if you don't, it's been a while since you've heard from me. I've had a busy couple of years teaching, doing research, adjusting to the new post-COVID shutdown normal, and traveling to locations from Argentina to Zambia. That whole time, I've always intended to come back to Voyages to share some of the stories I've come across on those travels, and my schedule is finally starting to allow me to do so again. For those of you that are new to the show, welcome aboard. Voyages is a celebration of our world, a platform for sharing the natural and cultural stories it tells, and an exploration of the destinations where those stories unfold. It's very much a labor of love for me in which I get to dive deep into some of my favorite places and topics, but given that it's been on hiatus for 3 years, I have a lot of work to do to rebuild my audience. The main thing you can do to help me do so is to take a moment to rate and review Voyages wherever you're listening to this. I'd also really appreciate any ideas you have for future episodes, particularly if there's a destination you'd like to join me to discuss. If you have ideas, questions, or comments of any kind, you can reach out to me on social media or at voyagepod@gmail.com. Because I hope to inspire you to visit the destinations I cover and to give you the tools to do so, Voyages does have an associated website, voyagepod.wordpress.com, where I share background information about each episode. In this case, though, since this is a two-part episode, those details won't be posted until after the second installment is released in a couple of weeks. The reason for the longer show is that my return to podcasting is an exploration of a landscape I know well, having lived on both its eastern and western edges at different times in my life. It's an unexpected landscape, an island of cliffs and peaks in a sea of grass and farmland. To understand why it exists, let's return to this island's eastern edge a few miles upriver from Frank Lloyd Wright's home. Just east of Cross Plains, Wisconsin is a north-south running ridge. You'll probably cross it on the road to Taliesin if you're approaching from Madison, Milwaukee, or Chicago, but unless you're looking for it, it's unlikely to make much of an impression. It may not inspire the same sense of awe as the Grand Canyon or Continental Crest in Glacier National Park, but this small hill marks an equally important geological boundary. The ridge is a moraine, specifically the Johnstown Moraine, a distinctive feature formed by the two great geological processes that sculpt our planet's surface. The first of these is erosion, the prying up and removal of rocks and sediments from Earth's surface. The second is deposition, which occurs when sediments are dumped out by the forces that eroded them. The Johnstown Moraine was formed when some force eroded rocks and sediments far to the north and deposited them in rural Wisconsin. If you were to dig into it, you would see that whatever it did so was immensely powerful, capable of carrying anything from flower-sized particles to boulders the size of houses. You'd find similar, though smaller, moraines today at the edge of glaciers, sheets of ice commonly located on mountains. From observing these modern glaciers, we know how they form, from the buildup of snow over many years when climates are cooler and more snow falls in the winter than melts in the summer. We also know how they behave. The huge weight of the built-up ice strains the bonds between molecules and allows glaciers to flow like an extremely slow liquid. We can observe how, as they move imperceptibly across a landscape, they erode the ground below by plucking up all sizes of rocks. We can also observe how, when temperatures warm, they then deposit those sediments, dropping them in a line marking where the glacier began melting and retreating. This is the origin of the Johnstown Moraine, a ridge of rocks and sediments that melted out of a glacier at its furthest extent. But whereas glaciers and their moraines mostly occupy individual valleys today, the Johnstown Moraine is one of the clearest remnants of a vast system of glacial features. You can trace it in a meandering line across Wisconsin, along the shores of the Great Lakes, all the way to Long Island Sound in the east and Puget Sound in the west. To the north of this line, the landscape bears all the signs of glacial erosion, which you can see across the Badger State. The indiscriminate rock-plucking of glaciers means that they can act like giant sheets of sandpaper, smoothing and flattening the landscape they flow over. This is, in part, what gives the upper Midwest its notorious flatness. Just looking at a map of Wisconsin and its neighboring states shows all the telltale fingerprints of glaciation on a huge scale, the vast featureless swath of land a testament to the enormous glacier that once moved across it. Today, lowland ice sheets are restricted to the poles, but during the Ice Ages, culminating around 20,000 years ago, a cold global climate meant that ice covered nearly all of what is today Canada, with lobes extending down into what would become the U.S. It was the edge of one of these lobes that formed the Johnstown Moraine when the most recent glacial advance stalled out. The mix of sediments that form the moraine are an example of what geologists call glacial drift. You'll find drift across most of Wisconsin, the calling card of waxing and waning ice sheets. One place you won't find it, though, is at Taliesin or the surrounding area. This lack of glacial sediments is why the meeting point of Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa, and Illinois, and bordered by the moraines, has been called the Driftless Area. This region stands apart naturally and culturally from everything else nearby because of a twist of geological fate. As glaciers ebbed and flowed with changing climate, an area that escaped glaciation during one cold period would likely be covered in ice during the next one. For reasons still unclear, and probably a healthy dose of luck, the Driftless region was never plowed under by advancing and retreating ice sheets. While frozen water shaped the landscape in every direction, here erosion and deposition were left to the movement of liquid water, a seemingly small change with profound and spectacular results. Decades after building his home and studio, Frank Lloyd Wright designed another building that celebrated the landscape of the Driftless area. Riverview Terrace was built to be a gateway to Taliesin, a role it still plays today as the site's visitor center. To understand what makes this region special, it's worth lingering under the cafe's vaulted ceiling and looking out its unbroken row of windows across the Wisconsin River. Through the relatively narrow channel in front of you, an average of 10,000 cubic feet of water surge past every second. That number may triple if you visit during a rainy summer, as I did in 2024. It's in conditions like these, where water flows fast and at high energy, that erosion occurs. River channels like the Wisconsin's are classic examples of erosional environments, where strong currents pry up and carry downstream even good-sized rocks. This is why most riverbeds are rocky. Everything smaller has been eroded away. Another building in the Taliesin complex speaks to a different power of rivers, the power of deposition. Midway Barn, built in the 1930s, is a testament to the valley's farming heritage. Frank Lloyd Wright worked on his uncle's nearby farm during his childhood and wanted agriculture to be a part of the rhythm of life at Taliesin. While the barn he and his students designed no longer houses any animals, the fields below Taliesin are still being worked. The valley here is so rich and fertile because of the wealth of nutrients in its soils, and the source of most of those soils is the river. When the Wisconsin rises too high, it overtops its banks and water floods out onto the surrounding plains. No longer caught up in the flow of the river channel, it rapidly loses its energy and begins to drop whatever it's carrying. When the water recedes, the sediments stay behind, forming the flat, farm-friendly floodplains that follow the Wisconsin from its source to its mouth. It's to that mouth that we head now, to see how this power to erode and deposit is not unique to this river, and to appreciate the spectacular results of unleashing that power on a grand scale. As you head west along the Wisconsin River, the towns you pass through owe their livelihood almost entirely to a single industry, agriculture. At the end of the river, though, you'll find yourself in Prairie du Chien, whose mispronounced French name alone tells you that it stands apart from its neighbors upstream. On St. Ferriol Island, you can see a group of buildings that neatly sums up the city's history and explains its name and its location. The Astor Fur Warehouse was built to store the source of the city's wealth. Furs, especially of beaver and bison. The 1837 Brisbois House and 1871 Villa Louis show just how much wealth these goods made, first for the French-Canadian fur traders who founded the city, then for their American counterparts. The Grand Deuceman Hotel is a stone monument to the economic and cultural confluence point that Prairie du Chien once was. In this case, the word confluence is literal as well as figurative, because the fur trade did not run on roads or rails, but on water, from the lakes of the Canadian Shield in the east to the Columbia River in the west. It only made sense, then, that this trading hub should be built where the Wisconsin, an important link in the water route to the Great Lakes, met the continent's Great River. This waterway is so large and so important that the cultures that grew up along it simply refer to it as just that, the Great River. In the local language of the Meskwaki and Sauk, the term used is Massasibui, but the name most of us know it by comes from the Ojibwe to the north, whose lands include the river's headwaters. They call it the Missisibi, or as French and English speakers would render it, the Mississippi. The Mississippi has played many roles in American history, from artery of trade to inspiration for Mark Twain's novels, but it's not often thought of for its scenery. In the Driftless region, though, it's sculpted one of the continent's most impressive riverscapes, and it's done so through the same forces that shaped the much smaller Wisconsin Valley, erosion and deposition. You can spot all sorts of depositional fingerprints left by the Mississippi on the Driftless area. There are floodplains here, just as at Taliesin, but on a much larger scale. St. Ferriol Island itself is part of this floodplain. Villa Louis was built on an ancient burial mound to keep it from getting inundated, but there are less cataclysmic reasons for its existence as well. Prairie du Chien sits on the inside curve of a huge, 20-mile bend in the Mississippi. As with all rivers, its powerful main channel hugs the outside of the curve, while sluggish backwaters abound on the inside. A drive across the Marquette-Joliet Bridge between Wisconsin and Iowa will take you from the low-energy eastern side of the river to the high-energy western side, illustrating along the way what a big difference this could make. For over a mile, you pass over a series of low islands, including St. Ferial, defined and built up by a series of slow-moving channels. It's a depositional landscape of flat land and teeming with wetlands atop rich soils. It comes to an abrupt end when the road rises up to cross the Mississippi proper. The landscape ahead of you is an erosional one, defined not by islands and waterways, but looming bluffs cut by steep ravines. Along the Wisconsin River, erosion carved the hills that inspired Frank Lloyd Wright, but it's along this stretch of the Great River that falling, dripping, and flowing water molded the driftless area's most dramatic scenery. In doing so, it gave the region its unique character. In Voyage's next episode, we'll explore what sets it apart from the rest of the Midwest, and how so much of what makes it special, from Ice Age survivors to indigenous earthworks, is due to the movement of liquid water. I hope you'll join me for part 2 of this driftless voyage, and for all the voyages to come.